will go down in everyone's memory as Glazer's Last Folly or something like that. As you can see on both sides of the viewing screen, I've put up the names of people that I recruited to give very, very brief presentations and open it up for discussion. And while that discussion is going on, the next person is supposed to rotate in. And I'm sure this isn't going to work. But the last people on the list know that we might exhaust. You know, there's a total of 11 people here in 90 minutes. So 8 minutes each times 11 is 88 minutes. And so we're going to try to rotate through each topic in 8 minutes. But the last thing that I want to do is suddenly dry up all the questions. So the most important thing is the questions. And if we run out of time and we only get to number three by the end of the time, it will have been a great success. And you don't need to worry about the other things. You can talk to the people separately. So without wasting any more time, if I could jump to it immediately and ask Tom Valls to talk about affinity grids, and then Fred Sigworth will follow with a different kind of affinity grid.
Okay, so I'm supposed to talk about affinity grids, and that's a project in my group done by Deborah Kelly. And it was a very simple idea. We started out with basically trying to combine protein purification and specimen preparation to one simple step. And so we start with a Teflon block, which has holes in it. We then put, on top of these holes, we put a monolayer, which has nickel lipids in it. We add extract, which should have one protein with a his tag on it. And the idea is that over time, these his tag proteins will absorb to the lipid monolayer, and you can simply peel off, you can reduce the binding of the non-specific binding by adding some imidazole to the extract. And then once you had time for the protein to bind, you can touch the monolayer with a grid and simply peel it off, and you should end up just with the protein on your grid. And so, to my surprise, what we could do, we could actually pre-deposit the monolayer on the grid, and you can dry this grid and keep it at ambient environment for several months, actually. And then you just simply put your extract with the histag protein on top of the grid. You blot it and freeze it, stain it, whatever you want to do. And that works very nicely, and I thought I'd show you a different specimen today. So I'm showing you ribosomes. And and so these are the ribosomes with vitrified eyes. And just to really quickly show you, we can calculate 3D reconstruction. We didn't try to push the resolution. We just wanted to show that it works. We get a random orientation. We can get about 22 angstroms. Raw images, class averages, back projection. So that works pretty nicely. What is important is that you can actually elute your protein from the monolayer into a single drop. So you take several samples, you elute it into the same drop, and then you can actually judge what you have on the grid, both by EM, SDS page, Western blotting, and mass spec. And we found that usually we only get our protein on the grid. So it seems to work quite nicely. And so I put a whole list of advantages of monolayer purification, but I don't have time. And there are some additional advantages of the affinity grid. And one that I wanted to mention is particularly useful, which is this one down here. And so monolayer purification affinity grid is restricted to histag proteins. However, if you have an affinity grid, what we now did was to express histag protein A. So you can now attach histag protein A to your affinity grid, incubated with the antibody against the tag that you have on your protein or against the subunit of your complex, and then pull down the complex with the antibody. And that also works quite nicely. And I don't have time to show the results. But one thing I wanted to mention, these grids may actually become now available by Ted Pella, at least for a test period. If there is enough interest, you might be able to purchase these in future. And that's it.
While we have questions.
Just a quick question, Tom. Before we combine with Ted Pella, how do you pre-make your monolayers on the grid?
So yeah, of course. Yeah, and it works. I mean, we start them.
How do you do it? Are there tricks to do it?
There's a book by Glazer et al. that has a section on making lipid monolayers.
So the only thing that I should mention is that we also do holy column grids. And so you have to stabilize those with a column layer on the back, which is something Cantella has done for a long time. And then they're stable. I should also say it's not a magic bullet. When it works beautifully, but sometimes you have to tweak it a little bit to get it to work, and sometimes you just get too much background and it doesn't work. But when it works, it's beautiful.
Oh, that's interesting. Up until now, it sounded like it worked for everything as long as it was tagged.
No, it's not a magic bullet. And something I don't understand, sometimes when you have a complex in an extract, you just get this complex. If you use the same extract but try to pull a different protein, you get a lot of background, which I don't understand why.
We've had bad luck so far ourselves trying to imitate the technique, but we thought we just weren't up to speed. But we're still working at it. So, yeah.
So, judging from the micrograph of the 50S subunit and the reconstructions, there seems to be some problem with the contrast also because of the lipid bilayer.
The lipid monolayer contributes some contrast, but we have only, I don't know, pick 20,000 particles, something like that. We really didn't try to push the resolution. You might need more particles with the monolayer to boost the contrast.
So, Tom, in the example that you showed that was the ribosome, how was it, this is not heat-stacked ribosome, and were you trying to purify it out of a cytosolic extract? I didn't understand that example.
So this particular one was actually, we expressed the histac subunit of the ribosome, the mammalian ribosome, expressed it in E. coli, and then pulled out the E. coli ribosome because the mammalian subunit integrated into the...
John's next.
What?
Huh? Yeah, we have two papers out, and then one on monolayer purification, one on affinity grid, and the one with the complex is the protein A... antibody we hadn't time to publish yet, but it's working.
You say you have no preferred orientations. That's a little surprising with a histag and a nickel monolayer. Why do you think that is?
You want to make sure that you put a long linker between the histag and your subunit. And that's one of the few examples where actually having a non-oligomeric structure works better. Because what happened to us, when you have a dimeric structure, you have two anchor sites, and then you actually induce preferred orientations.
One last.
Yeah, that's what actually was. We have this whole library of tap-tagged yeast proteins, and that's what exactly that was the point of that. So it works sometimes.
It's really super. The reason I'm so enthusiastic is that I hope it'll be as gentle to a protein as affinity chromatography is, as opposed to carbon film. And in addition, for cryo, it tethers the particle. And the particle can't see the air-water interface and get damaged. So
it was on the list of advantages.
Yeah, it's great. So I'm a terrific supporter of it. I think it's fantastic. Fred has a different way of doing the same thing.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about a method that has also been published, and we didn't invent it. Some other people invented it.
The mic may not be on.
Some other people invented it. So actually, Elizabeth Kubelek developed this method of growing a two-dimensional crystal of streptavidin. What you do is you form a lipid monolayer on your little microliter vessel here of solution containing streptavidin and buffer. It forms a two-dimensional crystal thanks to lateral diffusion of the lipids. And it makes a crystal that is most ordered over the holes in the holy carbon film, and in fact is so strong that it will even withstand negative staining. And so this is a negative stain image of the crystal over a hole in the holy carbon. Turns out that it's not ordered over carbon. Now, the reason we did this was that we wanted to tether liposomes containing membrane proteins and wanted a way to have an affinity surface for it. And it turns out that in the 2D crystal, you have, in each unit cell, you have two biotin binding sites on the bottom and two on the top. So we just dope our liposomes with a few copies of a biotinylated lipid. And so here's an image. Here's a blow-up of the image. Now, the nice thing is that this substrate is a crystal, which means that all of its power, except for the randomness in the lipid monolayer, is concentrated in a few spots in the Fourier transform. So we can get rid of all of the substrate signal by just masking out about 1% of the whole Fourier transform, and so remove the crystal. So here's an image of a crystal that's not too good, but this is informative because here and there are some disordered regions. So we do this masking out of the Fourier spots, and the crystal's gone. And this is irrelevant to the present discussion, but we can also make the liposomes disappear. Ligo Wong, who's the postdoc who did this, built a MD model of the streptavidin tetramer. And from that, we can predict what the crystal images should be like. We find that in a CCD-sized micrograph, we can get information down to about 10 angstroms, and in fact can do a absolute calibration of the imaging process. So these numbers are spatial frequencies in inverse nanometers. That's it. Thank you.
So Linda's going to plug in. Questions?
Yes, Grant.
Grant.
We can't control the size of liposomes any better than anyone else. So this is we have a broad range of liposome size. You're saying these are small or these are big?
Small.
Our problem is getting them big, but depending on how fast you remove the detergent, small and slow detergent removal with dialysis in our hands gives us bigger liposomes. Yeah, but they don't have my favorite ion channel reconstituted into them. Yeah.
So just a comment that Patrick Schultz used
yes.
this methodology with biosimulated DNA as
a right.
concentrating DNA binding.
Exactly. So that's the person who did it first. Yeah.
There's, I'm not much of a biochemist at all, but there's a tag called STF, streptavidin, tevprotease, and flag tag. And so you can purify with the flag tag and then cleave it off with tevprotease, and that leaves a peptide that will bind to streptavidin. Yeah. That should should prove to be very useful with these.
Yeah.
STF, streptavidin, tevprotease, flag tag. Yep. Right. Any other questions? All right. Let's move on, Linda. As soon as you're ready.
Yeah, I have to be able to see this thing because it doesn't show.
Oh.
Pepper, can you see it?
You're close. Almost. Almost there. To the left.
Push it.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, so I work for Gatan, and I designed this little plunge freezing apparatus. We have one here because I'm doing some work in Ron's lab for the past few weeks to test its ability to freeze samples that are salt sensitive. So Liz and I are going to do demos for you. I'm going to actually keep the instrument here through the end of break tomorrow morning. So if you don't get a chance to see it today, you can see it tomorrow. But anyway, the main criteria for the... Do we have in those things, laser pointer?
It was on the table.
Somebody stole it.
Oh. So, who has the pointer?
So I wanted
here it is.
So, good.
I hope it works.
So, Oh, not the green. Okay. I wanted it to be easy to use for a novice or an expert, and I wanted to make it a very versatile design so that anybody could modify it for different types of experiments. And I wanted it to produce what I would want to see, which would be large area of frozen hydrated grid atlases that have very uniform ice once you work out your parameters, with the idea that you could be able to produce one grid for an entire data set and to minimize the number of cryotransfers into the TEM column to minimize contamination, because usually the way it used to go when I was collecting data, by the time you got to the fourth or fifth grid, you finally had the perfect grid, but the contamination level was too high to collect a really good high-resolution data set. So, So this is what it looks like, and just quickly, I was supposed to only use two slides, but I put a little animation here. So there's a paper cutter here, so you can cut any filter paper you want. And the chamber is removable so that you can adapt other chambers to do different types of experiments. Here's an example of this large area grid atlas that I was telling you about. And this would be a typical example of what I get. So this is part of one grid square, but very uniform ice, hardly any contamination, blah, blah, blah. And another thing that I want to add to this is the Solaris 950 is a plasma cleaner that is made by Gatan that I'm not quite sure how it's working, what the surface chemistry is doing on this machine yet. I've talked to people at Gatan about it that designed it. But on the right-hand side is typically what I get by just taking, say, a quantifoil or C-flat out of the box with no chemical pretreatment, just putting it in the Solaris from anywhere from 5 to 15 or 30 seconds, cleaning it with the hydrogen, oxygen, plasma, and then doing my frozen hydrated prip. These grids will stay hydrophilic for a very long time, on the order of months, I think. And this is an example, although this grid has a lot of really good areas of ice on it. When the grid is not uniformly hydrophilic, you get this kind of blotchiness. So this is more what I get with the Solaris, so it makes a really good partnership. And one of my beta sites, two great beta sites that I've been working with in development is with Nico Grigoriev and Danny Nicastro and David at Brandeis, of course, and with Wachu and company and Baylor. So this was produced. This is a lipid sample that was done with CP3 and Solaris in conjunction, the two of them together. And this was done by somebody who had never prepared a frozen hydrated grid in her life. This was her first grid, so. No. Not quite. I mean, I've done it, so. It works. Anyway, I'm happy to, Liz and I are happy to give you demos of the equipment and show you Solaris as well if you want to see that. So that's it.
Thanks very much, Liz. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what it is. The hydrogen oxygen plasma is already the proper gas mix is already part of one of the recipes that's there. And I think what people have been doing, at least what I've been hearing, is that they're used to using different types of machines to plasma clean their grids, so using room air or something in an Edwards or something for 4 minutes, and that's way too much time for this. You really only need several seconds and you get this cleaning very quickly and very uniformly on the grid. So I can talk to Steve Coyle and see what the actual numbers are for the mix of the gases, but I think it's pre-programmed in for the hydrogen and oxygen. It should be pre-programmed. So, and I'm just using the standard recipe for grids, yeah.
So we go to 950, and it's really interesting. Is there some literature that can tell you about the significance of, say, all of these parameters, like the RF strength, the pulse width, and all of this?
You should check on the Gatan website. I have a lot of stuff it's my machine is Cryoplunge 3. I just call it CP3, and there's a lot of information there, and I include stuff for the Solaris, but there's also on the specimen prep page of the Gatan website, there's a lot of information there for the Solaris, and I can put you in touch with Steve Coyle as well, who's one of the designers, or John Hunt, who's one of the designers of the instrument, and they give you very, very highly technical explanations of these things that I don't know about. Anything else? See me or Liz afterwards if you want a demo. Okay.
Thanks very much, Linda.
Thank you.
The next speaker is John Weinman from FEI, who will be talking about the VitreBot, but with special emphasis on what they're planning to do, you know, what's coming.
Hi, my name is John Weinman. I'm the Director of Business Development and Strategic In-Licensing for FEI. And my job is mainly to bring in new technologies to FEI. I've been asked today to talk about plunge freezing, and I have one slide on the VitroBot. Again, it's the established industry standard. We have about 200 placements right now. It's been used in generating numerous scientific results and hundreds of publications. So really, we essentially created, with the help of our design partners, a new industry segment. We have about 7 years of applications development, good critical mass, and a strong user base. But what I'm really here to talk about today is really what the future is, not my wireless network. And really, what are the future needs in this space, or the space around the VitroBot? So we have a need for automation, cryogenic isolation, contamination removal, and protected transfer to the microscope. We have environmental needs, essentially getting your experiment closer to the vitrification process so we can control time, so we can control the environment, control of activation, termination, and vitrification, what I call dynamics, or looking at biomolecular dynamics to catch that snapshot of the things that we want to capture, correlative information using the big toolbox of fluorochromes and affinity chemistries that have been produced in the optical world to help us get our work done, what I call fine control of chemistry, and Tom Walls gave a great example of purification, affinity surface interactions combined with microfluidics, really in the context of the sample carrier to help us really control that chemistry. And then again, quality control before the microscope. So our future roadmap at FEI starts with automation, and I'll give you a couple of movies here. This starts off with our autoloader VitroBot concept. And it is essentially fetching the auto grid. We start with a container of grids. The tweezers come down, and then a sample preparation or sample application device will then apply a very small amount, because you have precious materials, to the grid. The point here is that potentially we may not even need to use blotting, which is one of the higher sources of variability in the whole plunge freezing process. We'll then vitrify, and then we'll take it over in a controlled environment down to the cartridge, which will then be transferred safely to the microscope. So the prototype that we're working with currently is actually this. That's the transfer device. That's the container with the ethane and the cartridge. It rolls underneath the VitroBot. We blot. We go down. So all of this is essentially taking about six steps where you have the room to be. So it takes about six steps that you could normally ruin your grid or contaminate your grid, and essentially reduces that step to one. The results from the prototype are very, very impressive, essentially no hexagonal ice and virtually no contamination. So again, these are things that we're working on right now at FEI. To move forward in the future. One of the things we're working on is a glove box. So this is, as you can see, the normal VitroBot, and this is the environmental control, essentially being able to create an incubator underneath and get your experiment closer to the vitrification point so you can catch that time point or control your operation. This is a science article from Nico Sommerdijk in the calcium carbonate important in bone formation. We also are working on in design phase for, right now we have both an integrated and a non-integrated solution in place as far as correlative microscopy. Potentially one of the places where correlative microscopy could be a great benefit is to actually incorporate it into the vitrification device, essentially being able to create regions of interest up front and also QC as well. Fine control of chemistry. Tom Walls gave a great example of controlled chemistry. There are other chemistry solutions in place today. This is one from Dune Sciences, essentially creating a Lego set of surface linkers that you can essentially create affinity chemistries and customize solutions that eventually you'll be able to put into what I call down here a nanoreactor, or be able to have microfluidic solutions that will allow you to do lots of interesting things. So here's kind of the utopia of the space around the Vitrobot. So we can imagine a space where we have the ability to multiplex experimental conditions up front and get many, many, many different shots on goal, so to speak. We can work on sample automation, microfluidics. We can activate, terminate, and correlate. We can check ice thickness. We can also do time series, so T1, T2, T3. And we can take that cartridge, go into the microscope, and eventually produce lots of data. So essentially, this is a futurescape of where we'd like to be in workflow. Thank you.
Start to set up, please.
Questions?
Yeah. All right. Questions?
Yes. Yes.
Sarah.
So if you would have this work screen, then you apparently also need to buy a very large microscope in order to be able to use the samples?
Yes, but they're cheap.
You get one free with the system. Yeah. Yeah, and you'll notice the common carrier is that grid transfer device, and that would accept onto an auto-loading device on the microscope.
That's what I was wondering.
Yes.
Yes. Model.
Correct.
I think Andreas Engel is one of the main drivers for some aspects of this, or at least his lab is the beta site or alpha site.
Currently, that is currently on our Cryos platform. Is the autoloader cassette on the Cryos platform? That's essentially the first installed microscope with that system.
It's extremely important to have no contamination and to reduce any health risk. But also, I don't like things to break down, and so simplicity is very often very welcome because
what we're trying to do here is hard. There's no question about it. If you look at other fields in biology, sequencing, flow cytometry, they all started off 20 years ago with very, very complex manual, and in many cases it was able over time to be reduced into a box that people could operate in an automated way. I'm not saying this is going to be here tomorrow, but this is essentially the needs around this space and the opportunities for innovation around this space. And I rely on many of the people in this room to actually provide the ideas for what are the processes we want to automate and what are the things we want to do. Never automate a bad process. That's the first rule. Thank you.
So I have a question.
Oh.
So to follow up on Sarah's question, so this is obviously for the cryos, but are you going to put this cryos stage on all of your microscopes, basically? I think that would be an issue that people would be interested
in.
So do you have a timeline for this, or...? Yeah, but it should be adaptable to everything, right?
Might have it on T12.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
room temperature.
What?
There's a coffee cup mechanism below, so you can hold multiple cassettes. So he has, I think, 9 or 12 of these cassettes. This coffee cup type thing goes to the bottom of the oil load and makes three cassettes. It's all room temperature.
All right. The answer is no. We do not have a release date for when all of our microscopes will be backward in it. Thank you.
Don't go off stage. First of all, I wanted to ask the audience, are there things that you would like to see improved about any plunger, not any one manufacturer's plunger, but about plungers in general? We aren't having any commercial discussions. Technical capabilities, yeah.
Like a nice simple electrospray solution, like an add-on for electrospray.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that fits in with this concept, Grant.
And that would remove the blotting aspect, essentially, if you were able to do electrospray. I mean, blotting is one of the big variables in this process, for sure.
Another one would be integrated with the light microscope, so you could watch a process in the cell happening, and
that's
quality control.
Yes.
Well,
that is a problem.
One right here.
So we just got our VitraBot, and in the specifications, it was saying that it has humidity control.
Yeah.
And then we set it up, it has no humidity control. No matter what we adjust it to, it's at 100%.
Any humidity.
Well, that's a quality control issue, I guess. You have to.
No, we contacted them. They said that's by design.
Well, yeah, let's not have this a gripe session. I'm in an ideal world. One of the things that I caution people about is that they've got the temperature set, the humidity set, and everything, and then they take a specimen out of a test tube that might be on ice and a pipetter that's at room temperature, and they take out 2 microliters and expect it's still the temperature is at zero and so forth. So your chamber, your glove box chamber might address some of that, your pipetter, for example. Well, I think what we need, to be more clear about what I'm rambling here, is we need a way that all pieces of equipment in the chain, including the pipetter, have to be at the same conditions as the controlled condition. Otherwise, so there's one graduate student that I supervised who was getting negatively stained samples in his cryo sample. They were negatively stained by the buffer salts because it was evaporating, and that got corrected. But there's a lot of little devil in the detail things in using the equipment, and if the equipment itself could pay attention to some of the things that good scientists might not think about when they use it. Okay, having used up too much time, one quick question yet.
We have an application note for removing one of the blot pads and putting a small clip in place.
Well, I've worked with somebody who did that. It seemed to work fine. Yeah. Now for something completely different. Rob Billhorn from Direct Electron, who, as you know, has a CMOS detector actually installed here, and you can get a demo on it, will give us a little quick introduction to it. Go ahead.
Thanks, Bob. So that was my fourth slide. There's a demo. You can come see it. So that's 2 minutes off my talk. This is probably a review for a large number of you in the room now who are here Friday evening for Richard Henderson's talk. But basically the idea of a direct detector is to get away from the scintillator that's present in our CCD camera systems and really is the limitation in the image quality we can get in the microscope. So the cartoon on the left sort of illustrates the principle there where electrons are converting their energy to photons, which are conducted through a fiber optic faceplate onto the CCD. And in that process, you get scattering of both electrons and of photons and a resultant imprecision in the location of that primary incident electron. The alternative to that is to do it directly, and instead of using a scintillator, put that electron right into a silicon layer. This image in the bottom here, I'm sure, is hard to see in the back, but illustrates the interaction of a high-energy electron with a silicon layer, demonstrates the scattering through that thick volume. What we're doing for direct detection is starting with a very thin sensitive layer right at the surface and collecting only the charge deposited by that primary electron in that thin sensing volume and thereby getting much better precision in locating the point of incidence of that electron. So that's where the benefit comes from in terms of resolution, is there's no scattering going on in those electrons. And we're collecting a lot of charge because that's a high-energy electron, so very high signal-to-noise ratio, those two factors combined give you this kind of DQE performance, which, if you don't have DQE curves memorized, is way beyond what you can get with a CCD.
Is that 0.5 Nyquist or half Nyquist?
That's Nyquist. That's Nyquist. The other thing that's exciting about direct detectors, because the signal-noise ratio was so high, that if you turn down the beam current and run the detector fast enough, you can get these sparse frames where now you're looking at individual electron hits. And what you can do with this is you can go and classify these clusters, take the center as the point of incident of that primary electron, and get to, you know, single pixel resolution, exclude large clusters, which are some fraction of electrons that come back and backscatter, and get extremely good transfer of contrast, essentially an edge profile that's, you know, one pixel wide. And in comparing what you get with film or with a direct detector in the traditional mode of just integrating signal like on a CCD to what you can get by counting, very significant improvement in performance right out to Nyquist. And we, as was said at the beginning, we have one of these on a microscope here in the back. This image was done full automation under Legendon, so it's integrated both hardware and software. And if you have the time, we'd love to show it off. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Rob. Yes.
So if you spread the beam and use the counting mode, then you might have drift. Is it possible to align each frame to one another? So that
yeah, so I glossed over a couple of things. We run this thing continuously, whether in integrating mode or in counting mode. And so you do have those individual frames to look at and do all kinds of things with, one of those being drift correction. Now, you have to have enough signal in each stack of frames to recognize features to do drift correction with. But for example, this image on the screen was done in a second and a half exposure, 2 second exposure, I've forgotten. But that's somewhere in the order of 50 frames, so you can look at the first 25 and the second 25, or the first 10 and the next 10 and the next 10, and do just that.
But one of the really interesting things, as far as I know, hasn't been done yet, but it'd be interesting to see how it works, is the electron exposure that's used in tomography might be, maybe 50 times less than in a normal image. You might take 100 times as many images, something like that. But if the tomographic images, which are already reduced dose, were taken with direct counting, but using enough dose to align as you have to for tomography, I'd like to know how that comes up. Bob.
What's the fastest frame rate?
The camera that's in the back room will run 25 frames per second, full frame. That's 12 megapixels. We can read subarrays at much higher rates, several hundred frames.
Grant. Yeah, good. Good.
How do you correct for drift when you've got one electron every 10 pixels?
Well,
right. So you can't correct for drift, but for our application tomography in the Polara, drift won't be a problem.
You might not be worrying about better than 20 angstrom resolution anyway, and so, you know, in tomography. So it looks like, you know, something really worth investigating for tomography. Any other questions?
Yes.
And Richard, I forgot to ask you to set up.
I should amplify that. It's unfortunate planning, I guess, that tomorrow afternoon some people might be interested in seeing the sights of San Diego. But I'd encourage you to delay your departure a little bit and see if you can see us do this cryo specimen tomorrow afternoon, just after the session ends.
Just about the direct counting mode, can you do it online or is it post-processing?
Currently we're doing a post-processing. You know, we're not that far in the development, but our anticipation is to try and move as much of it to real time as we can.
Okay. Sorry. As for everybody, you know, if anything, you know, piques your interest and you want to know more, you know who to go find to talk. And the people who are helping to support the meeting also have tables, so you know where to find them very easily. So thanks much. Next speaker is Richard Gursky, who is from FEI, and will describe what FEI is doing. They showed a CMOS detector at the microscopy meeting last August, and so he'll brief this audience.
Okay, yeah. So we had our Falcon camera. It was actually an alpha unit. So this is actually very early in our stage of development of the camera as a as an entire device. What we've spent most of the time on is something that Richard Henderson mentioned, doing experimentation to get a radiation-hardened device. And so as it stands right now, we had a couple of objectives that we wanted to accomplish with the Falcon. One that would be amenable to working with post-column filters so that the system needed to be retractable. Also that the electronics for the detector would be in close proximity to the detector. And the alpha unit that we had at M&M did not really have optimized electronics, although it was together in one package. Of course, the strong points for a CMOS detector is the fact that it can be used as a direct electron detector. And Dr. Billhorn kind of stole some thunder with that one. what we've done is we've measured, that's actually the cameras that appeared at M&M. So if you look at improving the DQA on compared to a CCD image, the Falcon with a three times better DQA can give you much more information from a single dose. So it allows you to go ahead and fractionate your dose more so that you can, and you'll still get usable images, or you know, maintain the same dose and have that much better image quality. So this is actually two curves of the DQA. The blue curve is a 4K CCD camera, and so this is at half Nyquist. And so these are actually measured values. This was off of or directly from our alpha unit. And we see that there's a substantial increase in a DQA. Now, I've seen a lot of different numbers between Dr. Henderson and what Bill just put up, a lot of different numbers here on the DQA. And at some point, we'll have to, you know, make a measurement and see where the numbers are really shaken out. But I guess the proof is kind of in the pudding. So we look at, in gold, I know for most of us, we really are not that interested in looking at gold. But here at 25 electrons per angstrom square, we're taking a look at gold beads. And we can see out here the 2.3 gold line. And then out here at a dose of only 6 electrons per angstrom squared, we can still see those reflections. And if we compare that to the amount of data that we can get out here, you see the amount of information that's actually in this FFT compared to 25 electron dose, and then down at six electrons per angstrom square, the signal is pretty much lost. This is a 300 kV.
It's my computer.
I got one more slide. Just give me one slide. Just one's all I need.
I won't promise anything, but I could try to get it up while you field a couple of questions. And
David will take over his chair.
Yes, Grant.
Why is it only pre-GIF compatible? Why can't we put it behind a GIF?
Well, the fact that it's retractable makes it compatible with a GIF. So it's compatible with a post-column filter. If you wanted to put it post-GIF, that would be great also, and probably even more advantageous because you do lose some signal with the GIF. So. Yes. Yes.
Andy,
okay, I'll restore it.
Question is, were the images taken in the same location?
The same exact conditions? I'm not exactly sure. Yes. To me, this is, this was nice, but this was less important than the next slide. Yes, but it, I would think that at a higher mag, it would give the advantage to the 4K CCD.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. And, as biologists, I think we're more interested in seeing what the camera could actually do here. And so here we took an exposure. We're looking at the 5 electrons per angstrom square. This is of TMV. And we can see here, this is a 4K CCD. And at the dose, about 5 electrons per angstrom square, we can see the 23 angstrom layer lines. But the camera was binned, so that's a 512 by 512 image. And then here on the Falcon, 512 by 512 binning, we can see both the 11 and the 23 angstrom lines. And then even when we bin it down just 2K by 2K, and I've had a couple people ask, what about the 4K image? But of course, it's a lot cleaner with the 2K by 2K. Also, we have a pixel size. We have 14 micron pixels. In the direct electron detector as well. So, and these are, aside from the difference in the pixel size, these were done at the same magnification. And these are on cryo.
Yeah, but here again, you see the TMV much better. And the CCD image than the other one. The other one's a bit, at least here from this, I don't see it at all, but see it pretty clearly from here.
Could be a question of the amount of defocus. I can't really see the tone rings, but.
Yeah. It was supposed to be 1 micron defocus on both.
Good point. So I'm going to ask David to take over his chair when I set up to.
Okay, Grant.
Are there?
This all this data is just off the alpha model right now, and the electronics have not been really tuned yet. That's one of the plans, but yeah.
Are there other questions? If not, I'd like to perform my latest song.
Okay, go.
No, actually,
you wanted to.
Yeah, but you don't.
Just hit them.
Empty the room. Any other questions from? Oh, Bob's almost ready.
Not quite.
Any other questions for people who came before?
I have a question for everyone, actually. Did anyone use Vitrobot to plot negative staining samples to get better dye distribution?
Anyone ever blot negative stain samples? Plain regular negative stain. I guess not. Have you?
No, we just got ours, so I will.
And now for something completely different again. I'm going to say just two slides to introduce the topic of coma-free alignment, setting the stage for some experimental work that Anchi has done along with following a visit by Dieter Tipke and myself. So focus just on this panel here. That the axial coma alignment that that you would normally do to get high resolution work is bringing the direction of the electron beam to be parallel with the optical axis, as it is in the second panel. But normally, most of us, when we do coma-free alignment, do not want to illuminate an area of, let's say, 20 micrometers on the grid. We will excite the C2 lens such that the illumination is slightly above the specimen. That would be called overfocus. And as a result, the electron beam is diverging. So on axis, the beam is still untilted, but within the field of view, there's an angle called the beta angle where the illumination angle diverges. And the illumination is parallel over the whole field of view only when the electron beam is focused onto the front focal plane of the objective lens prefield. And if you didn't follow me on what I said, then let's talk a little bit later offline. But the prefield of the objective lens acts as one more condenser lens, and you have to be focused on the front focal plane of the objective lens prefield. Yes? For any lens to have parallel illumination. I think that's correct. For to have really parallel illumination. Ah, the computer doesn't work, even for my own slide. I'm not sure that you'll do Control Alt Delete and try to restart it. Try Escape.
Yeah,
Escape wasn't working. All right, so what the next slide will show is that. So the task. And you can kill that little window. Oop. Now we've got to find. So do shortcut to coma. And the second slide. Thank you very much, Linda. That wasn't meant to be funny. The best laughs I would get when I'd lecture in biochemistry were things that weren't meant to be funny. All right, so to make this a little bit more concrete, when the beam is tilted, as in axial coma or in off-axis coma, it introduces a large phase error. And some of you will remember how Richard Henderson introduced a correction for the beam tilt when processing two-dimensional crystals. But when you're doing single particles, that's questionable whether that's going to be practical. And it's better to align the illumination if you can. The table illustrates, for the case of a 200 kV microscope and CS 2.5 millimeters, that's more or less typical. If the beam tilt is 3 milliradians, then at 7 angstrom resolution, there's a 48-degree phase error. That's pretty bad. And then it gets bad as the third power of the resolution as you go up. So at 4 angstroms, 262, if you just let it wrap around a little bit more, it'll be back where it's supposed to be. So for 1 milliradian beta angle, the particles at the edge of the field of view will have 45-degree phase error at 5 angstrom resolution and almost 90 at 4 angstroms. So it's very important to get that beta angle small, as well as to do the coma-free alignment for axial coma. So two other points, which will be shown in the slides that Anchi is going to show you, that when the beam is tilted, if the beam tilt angle is large enough, it actually produces a different amount of astigmatism on the edge of the detector than in the center of the detector. That, when it's that bad, then you're really talking about 5 or 10 milliradians. And, the phase errors are absolutely wretched. The data at the edge of the detector is completely useless. I think that's probably the main... So the bottom line is the phase error may be severe at resolutions higher than 6 angstrom. Phase error may be severe at resolutions higher than 6 angstroms. under conditions that are commonly used with the illumination focused on the front focal, with the condenser lens over-focused, not focused on the front focal plane the way it is supposed to be done. All right, so rather than discuss questions you have about what I said, let's have Anchi show you some experimental work, and then we can field questions on all topics. So kill this one.
Does that work?
So yours should be down.
Well,
is yours down here?
No, Dina has been killed.
Yeah.
Well, it's desktop. I can find this.
Just
get rid of this.
Yes. That's the negative yet.
Yes.
Minus.
All right, with Bob's introduction, I'm going to tell you about the implementation of comma-free alignment tools in Legendum. So the reason we wanted to do this is because we want to take the alignment, comma-free alignment, during a very long automated Legendum run. So Jim and I have been working on this in the last few, months or weeks. I can't remember. Everyone's Ohio. So Bob already mentioned the biggest problem with bean tilt is that you will get the phase error in your data in a high resolution. At the low resolution, what you would observe are, with a very large amount of a tilt, you will see that the defocus, the relative to where it's perfect, the defocus will change and astigmation will change. So we're going to use this property in order to do the alignment, measure the amount of the tilt as well as doing the alignment. The reason what this is made possible by using by knowing that at higher beam tilt, all these kind of effects are stronger. So this is what is called the Zimdin. Tableau that's developed in 1978. So Zimdin Tableau is a representation in which that you show a group of different bean tilts related to where you want to measure the bean tilt with. So say, for example, for an actual coma value of 0.2, which is a very typical value that we're trying to remove the misalignment of, if you look at what the power spectrum looks like, they actually don't look that different from the one that's without the tilt. So you had a comma-free situation. However, if you tilt the beam by 5 milliradians and paste it onto here to represent a different direction of the tilt, then what you will notice that the opposing image is on here would have identical astigmation and defocus if you are at a comma-free axis. On the other hand, if it's misaligned, then these two would look different on the two sides. So it makes a very small amount of a misalignment becomes very, very observable. And so we're using this for our calibration, and now we can make a measurement. So the calibration, since it will change both defocus and astigmation, so you can choose what you want to use. We found out that the defocus is what we can measure more accurately, so that's what we decided to do. So we have a calibration made. So now if I'm making a measurement, I can actually get a value of what the value of that tilt angle is. And so far what we found out is that at the moment we have a have a precision or accuracy of somewhere between 0.15 to 0.3 milliradians. We hope we can improve this further so that we can get a better alignment every time. So one experiment that we did when Bob and Dieter came was that we tried to find out what our off-axis bin tilt coma was. And once I had this calibration, now I can actually assign those numbers onto what we actually measured out. So this is the result. At 120 kV and the C2 aperture is at 100 micron. With 1 micron beam, which is typical of what we are using, and 0.4 micron CCD, so that is inside of the beam. We did the measurement at the middle of the CCD and the corners of them. And it turns out all the corners has a 0.7 milliradians difference in comparison with the zero. So that's a very large value. If you remember what Bob showed, it's going to be enough to create only a range of 50 degree of error. So that's what I have.
Other questions?
Yeah, are you saying in the last slide that 0.7 is the best you can do?
It's not the best we can do. What we can do is reducing the C2 aperture. If we use the 50 microns, that number should come down by half.
Yeah. So why don't you use 50 microns then?
I just did a quick experiment the day all of you arrived.
Other questions?
If you could vary the current of the mini lens in the F20, then you would be able to adjust the parallelism of the beam.
Yes. So one of the recommendations that Dieter is really strong about is that if you have an FEI instrument with a twin lens, you do much better using the nanoprobe than microprobe. Plus, use a 40 micrometer condenser aperture. That's one good solution. We are writing this up actually.
Or alternatively, if you're using a JL, you just change the alpha selector.
Well, if you know what you're doing, then I don't need to tell you what to do.
Yeah, David.
Those images I showed you is at a spot 5. And when we were trying the nano probe mode, we were using spot 1, and we can get comparable intensity with spot 1. So that's still worse.
Okay. Set?
Yeah. So Bob asked if I would say, we've been trying to work out whether we could afford a CC corrector if it was available from anybody, but obviously FEI apparently is quite expensive, on a Titan Crius, so that you could use very thick specimens, you'd say a micron of ice, and then use all those lovely inelastically scattered electrons to help form the image that at the moment we only use elastic electrons for. And there is one paper published about CC correctors, not in biology, because there isn't a Cryos with a CC corrector, but there is a Titan, or a couple of them, with CC and CS correctors, and one of them is at Argonne, and Bernd Cabeus is the person who runs it. And he has a paper, Cabeus et al., showing that using the 100 electron volt energy loss electrons and throwing away all the, you know, the zero loss ones, so quite a wide window, with the CC corrector on, you can get resolutions beyond 3 angstroms. So, in other words, those inelastic electrons pick up all the phase shifts the same as the elastic ones and give you a high-resolution image just like the elastic ones. And so that if you can have both of them there, you can make up for some of that loss. Now, the specimen that they used was only a couple of 100 angstroms thick. So actually, there wasn't really the same kinds of thick specimens that you have in say, tomography. So we thought we really need to know as soon as possible whether the, you know, what will happen if you have a thick specimen. Since there isn't a cryos that allows you to put a frozen ice specimen in, we thought, what specimen could we use? And our idea was, just use thick carbon. So this is a piece of thick carbon, 1,500 angstroms thick. We think that's equivalent to 3,000 angstroms of ice. And by using 80 kV rather than 300, it's equivalent to a 300 kV experiment with about 7,000 or 8,000 angstroms of ice. So we think this is realistic, but and it's at room temperature, and you can do it now. And then, this is the transmission. This is electrons coming through the specimen that are neither elastically nor inelastic; they're just straight through. And then this is the voltage, and we measured it. So it's about 50% of them come through at 300, and it goes down. And we've got about 18%, 20% at 80 kV. So then the experiment consists of putting our favorite specimen, still, bacteria rhodopsida. and it doesn't seem to like us. Shall I do?
I think it's Wah's memory stick. Next. Well,
should we take it out? Take it out. Do you think it makes a difference?
Maybe.
Well, now it's stuck in there.
Sorry,
no,
I
try it all the time. Maybe it's just.
Okay, so.
Give that man a free
So here is CC equals 2 millimeters, CC equals 0 millimeters. Room temperature, 2D crystal of bacteriodopsin with spots. And on the bottom, you have the same thing on this 1,500 angstroms of carbon, equivalent to, say, 7 or 8,000 angstroms of ice at 300 kV. And then if you look at the spots, there's lots of lovely spots on, this is thin carbon at the top, this would be a normal image. So here would be, let's say, this is at 30 angstroms, 27 angstroms, and there's spots further out here we've circled. These ones go all the way off the edges of the detector. On the bottom ones, however, the spots are much weaker. So for example, you can just see, this is the 1-1, so here is the 1-1, and if you look for the other spots, you can just see a 2-0, just visible. And there are no others. And it's more or less the same, whether it's on a CC-corrected Titan or a non-CC-corrected F30. And we've done tried to quantitate it. And this is the last slide. So what we do is we measure the amplitude of that reflection. And since it's a 2D crystal and they're all the same, we know exactly what the amplitude should be. Of course, it's in a detector, and these detectors are really not very good. This number here, the amplitude of the the 1-1 reflection compared to the direct beam, this should actually be about 0.8%. You know, these detectors, you know, they kind of lose a lot. So, and also I should say the detector on the Titan was a 1K 15 micron CCD, whereas this one was a 2K 24 micron. And it was binned, so this is like 48 micron pixel versus 50. So there's no significance for the fact that on the thin carbon, this gives you slightly bigger contrast than that. This is essentially the control experiment with the thin carbon film. You then go to the thick carbon film, which has 18% of unscattered electrons, and something like 82% scattered, and the contrast drops. And also, we have an objective aperture in here, which doesn't make any difference here because there's very little high-angle scattering. And the contrast has dropped from whatever it was on thin carbon due to various types of scattering in the thick carbon. It's dropped to about 55%. And it may be slightly better when you have a aberration-corrected microscope, but it doesn't miraculously go back up to 100%. So that is the data. I hate to extrapolate further, but it doesn't look like that the improvement that you get with thin specimens, which you can convert to using the inelastic electrons, when you have a thick specimen, it's probably the case that the elastic high-angle scattering is the thing that's killing you. So it's a slightly disappointing result. Shocked because you know we haven't discussed this at all in the meeting so far, so we're not quite.
Don't you want to have a thick sample when you want to test, not the thick curve at all? Because the CCD vector would allow, if you had a very thick bacteria reduction, it was 5 times thicker than expected, then you would be able to focus the inelastically scattered electrons from the VR into the spots.
Now, let me say that the philosophy of the experiment, if you're doing, I mean, Our question was concerned, is it useful for tomography, right? You can ask a different question, is it useful for very high resolution? And there's absolutely no question it is. And that's what this published experiment shows, that you can use the inelastic electrons to get really high resolution, provided you have a CC corrector. If you don't have it, there's nothing there at all. In the published paper, it's a big, big factor, 10, 100 or something like that. But here we're only looking at and the idea was to use a specimen that you could guarantee that you know exactly the amount of contrast to get out, and then numerically quantify what happens if you have it going through 9 or 10 micron of ice. And that's exactly the situation. You have a cell, a bacterium, like Grant showed this morning. In it, you've got a ribosome. The ribosome is 100 angstrom thick or something like that, and it's got a micron of ice. So we think it's a valid test that you can do now rather than waiting for 2 or 3 years until you have a CC-corrected cryos and money, of course.
was your crystal on the top or the bottom?
Okay, so yeah, no, we were very interested in that. We tried it with thin carbon, of course, doesn't matter because it's there's not much inelastic scatter or elastic scatter for that matter. We tried it quite carefully on the... What do you think the answer will be, David?
I wouldn't have asked the question if I knew the answer.
Okay, well, we thought it might be better on the bottom, but actually, it didn't seem to matter. We tried quite hard top and bottom, and they were about the same. If you don't put an objective aperture in, the contrast is down to about half. So that means some of it's got lost, and it's the same top or bottom.
Any other questions? All right, Fred, are you set up?
Thanks. Let's see, a microphone.
So now we're going to have two presentations about phase contrast, which is
right.
Definitely still in the future.
Well, okay, so there are several different kinds of phase contrast devices. Bob is working on one. I spent my summer vacation in Japan trying to use this one. The idea of the faceplate is, of course, something that's placed in the back focal plane of the objective lens. It does not shift the phase of the unscattered electrons, but shifts the phase of the scattered electrons. And we know in light microscopes that a faceplate makes all the difference. So this is a Fujiyoshi-type microscope, and the faceplate is mounted in this aperture holder-like device up here. And the specimen is inserted into the top entry lens up at the top. The faceplate device that Nagiyama and Danev use is a thin carbon film with a hole. Usually the hole is smaller than a micron diameter. It's drilled with a focused ion beam. And the problem, there, of course, there are technical problems. That's why not everyone is using them. The problems are contamination. If you have any kind of organic contamination that can get charged, then that's going to spoil the phase shifts of the electrons going through. Also, aging of the carbon film seems to produce problems such that after the carbon film has been in the microscope for a week or two, it makes charging even though it's been held at 200 degrees and is presumably very clean. So there is something going wrong with the aging of the carbon film. Also, the more you bombard it with electrons, the more charging-like effects you have. And so the result then is that you get phase shifts out here that are not exactly 90 degrees and are varying with spatial frequency. And so you get, and maybe varying with time also, so you get high B factors. So when it's working, it's really great. What it does is it converts the sine of the wave aberration function into the cosine of the wave aberration function. And so you get lots of transfer at the low spatial frequencies down to something on the order of 200 to 400 angstroms, which is the so-called cut-on frequency. So there's a phase contrast image. Here is high, medium, and low defocus. You can see there's a lot more contrast there. And theoretically, you have just as much signal, if not more signal, than you would get with defocus contrast. Here is a standard defocus contrast image of a cryo specimen. These are little bits of frost, and you can't really see the particles here. The particles are KV1.2 ion channels in detergent, so they're very. It's hard to see particle, even though they're about 300 kilodaltons in size, but probably that's a particle. You can see quite a few around here. So you can see that it makes all the difference for seeing a small particle in the microscope to have these low spatial frequencies. The image is not very good. This was taken when the phase plate device had been aged, and so the high frequency information isn't really there. But Waugh will tell you about what happens to how good the high frequency information is. Here's some liposomes, like I was showing you at the beginning of this session, and you compare the defocus contrast and the phase contrast. You can see a lot more. You can see this little, that's probably one of my membrane proteins poking out there. There's another one. So we think that we can see more. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Fred.
This hold, so this is probably a better image. The bilayer is pretty much just a rectangular profile. That's what's computed, and of course in the defocus contrast it turns into something much more complicated.
Are you familiar with the paper in PNAS? Done for a completely different reason, in which Fred's lab was able to measure the potential in the membrane due to the dipole groups of the polar head groups of lipids. And this image is an artifact of the fact that you're boosting the second harmonic of the Fourier transform of a rectangle function. Yes?
I understand that they can heat up these phase plates. Is that correct for that charging problem?
No. So it seems to be a trade-off. At lower temperatures, you get probably organic contamination. At higher temperatures, the film is starting to degrade. You know, this is amorphous carbon, and I don't know what's happening, whether carbon is evaporating off or reorganizing, but the phase plates get worse at higher temperatures also.
I mean, to sort of regenerate, because it tends to accumulate stuff on it to make it back to its...
They haven't been able to find a way.
Yeah. A better material is needed.
First, Nico.
You might have mentioned it, but the defocus on the KV pole, what was that?
So that was nominally zero defocus in the phase contrast image. It was 4 microns in the conventional image.
Four.
Yeah. At 300 KV. Yeah.
My understanding is that you have halos, white and dark halos around the structures, depending on maybe the shape or the size of the hole. Mm-hmm. The phase
Yeah.
Can you then take
it? So it, the faceplate acts like a high-pass filter where this cut-on is, you know, 200 to 400 angstroms. You also have fringes if the faceplate is misadjusted, that is, if the electron beam does not go through the center of the faceplate. You can correct for those. That is, if it's miscentered, pretty much all of the information, 70% of the information is still there, and you can correct it. But at lower resolution than below 200 angstroms, you just have regular old amplitude contrast, you know, the 7 or 10% amplitude contrast left.
Okay. Was all set up to go, okay. So he will continue.
So I like to tell you a bit about my experience with the faceplate, which was available in Nakayama's lab in Japan. And so the instrument I was using, actually, can you hear me without that?
No, please use it.
Please use it. I didn't wear the white shirt. I'm very nervous, you know. All right, thank you. Where is the pointer? David. All right. So the instrument I'm using, I use was a 200 kilovolt instrument. It's a Joule instrument with a fumigation gun, with a in column filter, and then with a teeth camera. Yep. So I'm just showing you two examples because about 2 years ago, thanks for this workshop, I listened to Bob's talk. And I was very impressed. Bob was very convincing anyway. So he showed me the idea of faceplate was a great thing to do. I wasn't sure because I'm a biology, what the heck I know, right? So, and having heard that, I decided I wanted to try that out. So this was an image that we took with the faceplate with the 200 kilo instrument recorded in a CCD camera. So this is about 700 angstrom in diameter. You can see actually things sticking out. Which is the tail of the bacteriophage. So you can see that there's a halo around here because, as Fred talked about, this cut-on frequency, and that is actually a pinhole in the carbon film, and that is how that halo is generated. And so Nakayama's group showed that they used the GRO-EL to show about 12 angstrom resolution. I wasn't sure why 12 angstrom, why not single-digit resolution. So we used this specimen because we already have a 4.5 angstrom structure of this phase, so we know what the answer is supposed to be. So based on this, we actually did a reconstruction that we generate around 9 angstrom resolution. We can actually see the long alpha helix and beta strand. So I think these experiments convinced me that faceplate can possibly go beyond 10 angstrom resolutions. Now the question is, why still 9 angstroms? You know, what's wrong with that? So I did an experiment with my favorite specimen. It's called bacterial dobsons. And so when I did the bacterial dobsons, which embedded in sugar, and as you expect, you don't see much because the contrast matching between the proteins and the sugars, but we still see the edge of that. Now, instead of showing you this computer diffraction spot, we show this IQ plot. For those in case you don't know what IQ plot is, actually it was invented by Richard Henderson's to display the diffraction intensity computed from the image. So we actually give a grade to the diffraction spot. Those good, very strong signal to noise. We could IQ equal to 1, and then IQ to 8. I think in Richard's pioneering work on bacterial dobsons, he used diffraction spot up to 8 for reconstruction. So I think these experiments actually show that actually diffraction intensity go beyond 10 angstrom, around 8 angstroms. Now, as Fred points out, that one of the advantages is you insert a sine gamma curve, you get a cosine gamma curve. And the question is where the zeros are. Now, in the previous slide, I did not tell you, did I fix the transfer function at all? And in fact, when we did the analysis, up to 10 angstrom, we didn't need to do any transfer function corrections at all. Now, go beyond 10 angstrom, we were struggling, you know, at one single digit, you know, because this data was actually recorded in a Christmas day. You know, I was in Japan, shipped the data back in Houston. I want one more angstrom so I could be happily have a Christmas gift. And it turned out that one angstrom is very critical. And I actually get a gift in Chinese New Year, which is 2 months later. And the reason is actually take about 2 months to figure out that between the 10 angstrom to 9 angstrom, we needed to fix the contrast transfer function. Now, the reason is, why do you know how to focus? I would say I really don't know how to focus in this kind of condition. It's much, much more difficult to focus. So we thought we were in focus because when you do phase-based, these types of phase-based imaging, you're supposed to everything in focus. Search of the focus is the focus. So we actually needed a lot of adjustment. So all this data we were able, actually I didn't get, it's complicated how we actually figured out how to determine the defocus, but we did it, and the answer is actually correct. And so in this case, we also encounter the same difficulty. At 10 angstrom, it's no problem. In other words, at 10 angstrom, we could, one picture, we could repeat the classic experiment that Nigel and Richard has done some years ago. One pictures with no CTA corrections. And but again, go beyond 10 angstrom, we actually cheated a little bit. We look at Richard's structural factors and figured out beyond 10 angstrom, you actually need to flip the faces. Okay, that means the defocus is actually a problem. And then we did this very favorite, my favorite plot, which is called Richard's Wilson plot, which is what we did was to compute the Fourier transform from the images, and then you get the Fourier amplitude, and you compare the Fourier amplitude with the electron diffraction intensity, and then you plot the log plot and a function of d square, and then from the slope you can actually determine the b factor. This is Richard's b factor, the crystallographic b factors, and so it turned out this is around 800 something b factor. So I think that explains that actually this is pretty high b factor at the moment. But when you look at the phases in one of the typical best images, actually not too bad compared to Richard's and Nigel's phases. It's around 10 degree differences from that. So again, what it really told is beyond 10 angstroms, you need to flip the phases to get that. And so given that experience, I think this is quite encouraging based on this experiment in my point of view. That is not a low resolution technology as I thought of. It's actually got moderate resolution technology. I think by improving that, hopefully we could do, you know, all the way beyond 9 angstrom. I think that is optimistic. So given that, that's my wish list in the future. Right now, as Fred points out, the phase space is very short-lived, okay? The lifetime is short-lived. And in turn, now there is only one Japanese engineer was able to make a good phase space, and that guy was so good that he got promoted, he didn't make it anymore. So and so it's a real problem. So what Fred and I talk about, whether we can actually buy him, you know, to come to America just to make the phase space. So as a result, in changing the phase space, you need to break the columns. You know, with my previous experience in BobSAP, actually I know how to open up the column. That's very useful to know. But that's a real problem. And so I think what you really need is to make that phase space just like a specimen holder. You can just flip it in and out in 5 minutes. And I think that is really needed. And unfortunately, such thing doesn't exist yet. So I mean, and it's actually very pricey. Anybody have some money? I put my head around, collect some money to make that. And so that would be the most urgently needed piece of accessory. And then the other one is maybe get a better material in carbon film. You know, right now, Nakayama used this carbon, which may not be the best material to make the phase space. You know, there are some physicists around here probably can think about experiment different types of material. And then the automating for defocus is very important. I think I'm not sure that would be as easy, but I think it's probably doable, so but that is down the line. And then I think now doing the data processing, I think we took us a little while to learn how to process those data, but if you go beyond that, I think that would be a big challenge if you go beyond 10 or 9 angstroms. And again, in the data I get so far is 800 angstrom squared. It's just too large a B factor in any standard. So I think it may have to do with the charging of the specimen, maybe, or lens.
I think it's just using a CCD camera rather than film.
No. Okay. So Bob, we did another experiment. We changed the magnifications. Actually, it doesn't help. So that eliminated, it's not a CCD problem.
We have to talk about that offline because Rado and I did the same experiment and got the opposite conclusion.
Okay. I think my experiment is definitely correct because because I use purple membrane, you know, it cannot be wrong.
I agree. There's a hand.
That's what I was told, yes.
What about putting it at the back focal plane of the lens when we're down in the column?
We have one now in Houston. We're trying to experiment that.
Okay. Nigel.
It's really nice when people show face plate pictures if they can turn off until the fraction happens with them because it's really hard to judge them. I wonder, because of the extra scattering to the face plate film, is the time ring pattern.
Well, first of all, we don't have an optical bench anymore, so I can't do the experiment. And one of the problem, I think, in the purple membrane case, we actually was able to make up the transverse function ring a bit, but it's very faint.
Just as clear as a normal.
No, not as clear, because the thing is, we are fighting against two things. One is we want to do as close to focus as possible, and number one. And number two is that has to do with the CCD limits that actually die away in that particular setting. But when you take a carbon film images and really out of focus, you could see the CTF transfer function, no problem.
The way that Rado normally focuses is, you know, in the focus position off of the sensitive area of your specimen. You know, go out of focus, you see the tone rings. And he just keeps changing the focus until the first zero goes off Nyquist, and then it's in focus.
Well, yeah, that's the way we do it. In other words, use a TV camera to see the FFT, and then you shift it. But the problem is, actually, in order to do this experiment right, your unscattered beam has to be in the center of the hole, and that is a real challenge because it's a drifting problem in real life.
Andy? Electrostatic phase plates, I can't speak for everybody, but ours still charges when it gets hit by the electron beam.
I just want to tell you, this is only part one of my talk on Friday for those who want to change their airplane ticket. There's more stuff.
David.
Any estimate of what proportion of the electrons get scattered or absorbed by the carbon that's one quarter wavelength?
It's 21% of the intensity, and that gives you, if I remember correctly, 14% loss in the signal, because the signal goes as the square root of the intensity. That's in Nagayama, Glaser, and Donov, or the other way around, published about a year ago. Yep. Yeah, it's the same thing. Same thing. Yeah. Okay, Clint.